This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You've heard of the gender imbalance in Silicon Valley, right? Well, it's still there, but as of today, in one very high-profile case, a jury says there is no gender bias. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, the 27th of March. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. It took a little bit more than 3 weeks in the courtroom and 2 days of deliberation for the jury to get us to a verdict in the case of Ellen Pao versus Kleiner, Perkins, Caulfield, and Byers. It was a gender discrimination and retaliation case against one of the brand-name Silicon Valley venture capital firms, and the jury went Kleiner's way. Liz Gaines has been covering the case for Recode. We got her on the line on a cell phone in the courthouse, as you'll hear. Hey, Liz.
Hi.
So it was a big day for Kleiner Perkins. They have basically gotten what they wanted out of this case.
Yes. So Kleiner Perkins is not going to be liable for gender discrimination. They won on all the gender discrimination counts in the case by Ellen Pao, their former employee.
What does this case tell us? What has this case told us about the workings of the people who decide who gets the money in Silicon Valley, right? Because that's what Kleiner Perkins does.
Right. Kleiner Perkins funds the technology that you and I use every day to do everything. And we've learned for sure there is a gender imbalance in the highest echelons of the venture capital industry, of the technology industry. What was not established is that there is a gender bias.
Is there a way that this case rectifies that imbalance at all?
I think so. I think that this case has come to open up a conversation. And I don't know that that's the result Kleiner Perkins would have wanted, but it's probably more important to them that they won, because that's why they went to court. But the overall discussion, not just about their firm, but about this, you know, the little subtle injustices that happen every day to women when they're the only woman in a room, is something that people are now talking about a lot more openly. It does not, I wouldn't attribute that solely to the trial, but I think having a place to put all our attention, all of our attention on that topic has actually been pretty productive.
You know, you said Kleiner Perkins won, and objectively they did. I wonder if they suffer by reputation now. No?
You know, no question, but that's been the case, I think, since day one of the suit. I mean, we've been in court for a month. We've been writing for a month about all the really embarrassing things that they did. You know, they did not get off scot-free. So they may have won on the claims, and we'll see what happens all the way with the rest of the day. But they may have won on the gender discrimination claims, but I don't think that they're big winners.
Ellen Pao now goes back to Reddit, where she is the interim CEO. Kleiner Perkins, I imagine, goes back to business, right?
That's right. I mean, we've seen a lot of their partners in court, but their presence in court has been limited to their lawyers. So outside of the courtroom, they've been kind of waiting for this judgment, waiting for these 12 men and women to say whether or not they acted improperly.
The first time you and I talked at the beginning of this trial, I said it was the trial of the century, right? It had captivated Silicon Valley. When you went out to get a beer or a cup of coffee down in Palo Alto or Menlo Park, is this what people were talking about?
It is what people are talking about. I would not oversell this trial. I think that I've been very interested and excited about it. Mm-hmm. But I think it's important to realize that this trial is part of a larger context. It was in many ways, imperfect plaintiff and imperfect firm in terms of how they represented themselves in the case. It was pretty balanced a lot of the way through. And so I think that calling it the trial of the century, the content, the substance of the trial is less important than the conversation, perhaps, mm-hmm. the larger conversation around it. Right. And so I would put a lot of attention on that. I'm not siding with either party, but I think that it brought a conversation to bear, and that's what's important.
Liz Gaines, she's been covering the Ellen Pao Kleiner Perkins trial up in San Francisco. Liz, thanks so much.
Thank you.
On Wall Street today, traders just couldn't make up their mind. Stocks went pretty much every which way. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Mark Zuckerberg, the founder and CEO of Facebook, put up a post on, yes, Facebook yesterday, confirming that his company has been testing drones over in the United Kingdom. The basic idea is to beam internet service down from them using lasers. These aren't, by the way, quadcopters. These things are eventually going to have a wingspan wider than a Boeing 737, so they're big. Amazon, meanwhile, has also headed to the UK to test its drone delivery service. Why, you ask, all this anglophilia for drone testing? In one word, regulation. Here in the States, the FAA has proposed some rules that would allow some commercial drone use, but those rules are far from final, and permission does right now have to be given on a case-by-case basis. So Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson took a look at the possibilities for the U.S.-based drone industry in waiting.
Real estate agents, photographers, farmers, the list of people who might want to use drones at work is long and varied. But for now, they're largely grounded, says John Resnick. He works for DJI, a company that makes drones for personal and commercial use.
For us, that means a host of people who are ready to start operating commercially now are kind of on hold. So it's tending to have a little bit of a strangling effect on the industry.
Especially when you compare the U.S. to other places in Europe, Australia, or Canada, says Brendan Shulman. He's with the law firm Kramer Levin.
They have had a regulatory framework in place for commercial drones for a number of years, and it's a much more permissive framework.
Shulman says it could take another 2 years or so before the FAA has final rules in place. Last month, the agency released a draft for unmanned aircraft under 55 pounds, limiting flights to daytime and certain heights, among other things. It says it needs to balance safety and privacy with the economic potential these drones might represent.
It strikes me as a great start.
Brian Wynn is the president of the Association for Unmanned Vehicle Systems International. But he says the regulatory delays do have a cost.
$23 million a day.
That's what he figures a mature industry might generate once it's cleared for takeoff.
It's probably not as huge a cost today as it could be later, but the bottom line is the sooner we can fly, the sooner we can add value.
I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
There is a decent chance that if you see a vacant building for lease in your neighborhood, it's going to be an old bank branch office. Last year, the number of branches across the country fell by more than 1,000, and it's happening at institutions both big and small. Marketplace's Gigi Duban explains why and what it might mean for bank customers.
Between direct deposits and ATMs, walking into a bank isn't something a lot of people do anymore. Even applying for a loan. Used to be you'd meet up with a loan officer who would then collect what's known as soft information.
Which the loan officer would get by interviewing and discussing and looking the person in the eye.
Charles Kahn teaches finance at the University of Illinois. He says nowadays loan approval takes more of a by-the-numbers approach. Credit score, collateral, that sort of thing. So he says it makes sense that banks are closing branches to cut costs, specifically real estate and personnel.
And doing things remotely, you can have the same person handle a larger number of services.
Kahn says banks have a lot more competition from credit card companies and brokerage firms, for instance.
And so you've got things like Discover and Fidelity, who aren't banks or weren't banks, also providing the same kinds of benefits.
Paul Noring is a bank consultant for Navigant. He says branches offer a lot of handholding for people who find banking confusing. And he says a branch is like an ad.
Branches are the best way that banks can still reflect their brand with their customers.
Still, for most customers, it won't be a deal breaker. Ross Levine teaches banking and finance at the Haas School of Business.
I think for some people, there'll be an inconvenience.
Mostly, people who aren't comfortable banking online. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
We have possibly, just possibly, gotten to that point in the labor market recovery where companies have to work harder to get the workers they want. In the construction trades in particular, skilled workers like welders and carpenters and electricians are in especially short supply. These are jobs that, after an apprenticeship, can pay anywhere from $25 to $50 an hour. They come with health insurance and a pension plan. They're good, solid, middle-class, blue-collar jobs that women mostly aren't getting, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman tells us.
Women are now about 50% of the American workforce, but they're not taking home half the income. They make about 22% less on average than men. One reason is occupational segregation. Jobs where men predominate, like truck driver, carpenter, construction worker, pay significantly more than comparable female-dominated jobs, like secretary, cashier, and home health aide. Lauren Sugarman directs the National Center for Women's Employment Equity.
We've really seen desegregation of many occupations, bus driver, mail carrier, firefighter, but we have not seen the same movement of women into the construction trades.
Why that matters, says Sugarman, is lost earning power for women. Too many women making $16 or $20 an hour as secretaries, too few making $40 or more as roofers and electricians.
We are now 2.6% of the construction workforce, so very little progress.
Making progress starts in a smattering of nonprofit pre-apprenticeship and skills training programs across the country. They're supported by unions, employers, community colleges, and they teach women basic tool use, applied math. They take women to job sites to learn how to work safely on a scaffold 50 feet up.
Holly! Yeah. Mitchell is here!
I'm climbing up a ladder at a residential building site in Portland, Oregon, to meet Holly Huntley. She owns a small construction firm and regularly brings women onto the job site to train them.
Don't hit your head.
I really hate heights.
So do I.
How can you work construction if you hate heights?
I don't hate them. I just don't want to fall from them without being connected to something. Then it's actually really fun.
Huntley's hired two graduates from the Oregon Tradeswomen program that she teaches in. They'll make $26 an hour as journeyman carpenters. And she's glad to be able to offer a woman-run construction workplace.
I know a lot of women in the trades that experience harassment on a daily basis. I think it's like it's history, you know. I mean, it's a male-dominated culture, you know, with the catcalls and the racial slurs and gender-based slurs and jokes. And I can't have that. I have a really low tolerance for that.
Which totally suits Carrie Lean, one of Huntley's two female carpenters. She remembers her apprenticeship in Minnesota after college.
It was very challenging because there was a little bit of, like, the old boys club to toughen you up.
The dilemma Lean and Huntley talk about: go with the flow, don't say anything, or dish it back, just as crass and raw.
The way I was raised, being a woman, kind of like, don't ruffle the feathers and just take it through being in the trades. Like, I stand up for myself more.
You know, I don't know that I do anything concretely.
No really amazingly sexist jokes from you, right?
No. Sometimes Dan is the one that's offended, honestly.
The Dan she mentions, who might blush from the off-color women's humor, he's Dan Ewing, the lone man on this crew.
When I mention that everybody else in the company is a woman, people tend to raise their eyebrows, but it's really nice. I mean, men are... We're fine, but we tend to be pretty crass, and everybody's just more civilized.
Where there are pre-apprenticeship programs, like in Oregon, the number of women making it to construction apprentice and journeyman is rising. Unions and employers often support the programs to boost women's participation and to counter discrimination, and also to deal with a growing shortage of skilled workers. That support has made a big difference for Heather Mather. She's 32. Last year, she did a free training program with Oregon Tradeswomen and then...
became a union carpenter with Local 1503. Whoop, whoop.
Uh-oh. I'm talking about feet.
Oh, you want to build those?
And a bunny and a dog.
Mather's got three-year-old triplets. She's been making $19.69 an hour as an apprentice building a semiconductor factory at Intel.
Gender-wise, I didn't really notice any discrimination or anything like that. The crew was great. They were more than willing to show me what I needed to know.
She has been catcalled and propositioned. She says her supervisor has her back when she complains.
I'm not here for a husband. I'm here to work. I'm here to work my butt off and to take home, you know, a paycheck that I can live on.
As the economy improves and older men in the construction industry retire, there's an opportunity for more women to get those paychecks and move up the ladder, as long as they can first manage to get in the door. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up, you had better plan today for the unanticipated tomorrow.
A guy who specializes in the unanticipated tomorrow. It's part of our latest collaboration with the New York Times. But first, let's do the numbers. Upend to a down week on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials up 34 points today, nearly 0.2%, closed at 17,712. The NASDAQ gained 27 points, 0.5%, 48.91. The S&P 500 put on 4 points, 0.2%, ended things at 2,061. However, comma, for the week, the Dow off 2.3%. The NASDAQ down 2.7%. The S&P 500 dropped 2.2% lower. The Dow Chemical Company says it's going to take a big chunk of its chlorine business and sell it to its smaller rival, Olin. Dow shares up 2.8% today. Olin shares up 14%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 1.96%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases personal income and spending data for February. On March 30th, 1858, Hyman Lippmann patented the first pencil with an eraser on top. The patent was later revoked because he only combined two things that already existed. And Vincent van Gogh, who sketched in pencil, was born on March 30th, 1853. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A moment now, well, 4 minutes, actually, in which we will take apart what the past week brought in business and the economy and then put it all back together again. Here to do that with us are Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post, also Felix Salmon from Fusion. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, as it were. All right. So honestly, not a whole lot happened specifically that we want to talk about this week, right? GDP was fine. Janet Yellen gave a speech. It was boring, whatever, blah, blah, blah. So we'll
rates
talk
are going up.
I know. Shut
we
up. Felix, shut up.
Run
stop,
into the
stop,
sea.
Stop. Stop. We're not going to do that. We said we weren't going to do that.
No macro this week.
I would like to talk. Yeah, no macro. I would like to talk people to start us with, and I want to talk about a woman named Ruth Porat, who, Catherine, used to be the chief financial officer at Morgan Stanley. We learned this week she is going to Google. It is an interesting juxtaposition, this developing Silicon Valley Wall Street thing, huh?
Yeah, for a bunch of different reasons, including that it used to be Wall Street that was criticized a lot for not promoting enough women. Ruth Porat is known as like the most influential, most powerful woman on Wall Street. Silicon Valley has had the same accusation, and now she's making the transition and getting a lot more money, as it turns out.
She is, which is kind of amazing. But there's also, Felix, it's nice to see this happening with a woman, right? Getting a senior job in Silicon Valley.
Like hen's teeth, these senior female roles. And I mean, once you get past Sheryl Sandberg, it's like the and Marissa Mayer, that's like, that's about it. So yes, this is welcome news. And she's going to be a great CFO for Google. And, you know, with any luck, other CFO-less companies like Uber will start appointing female CFOs. I think that one's needed even more.
Just quickly, Catherine, on the pay thing. She's going to get $70 million, which I didn't really want to bring up because it's a little bit beside the point. But clearly the theory from Google is she's going to help them make that money back somehow.
Yeah, well, she's done a great job in her past role. She's very well respected. I think the assumption is that she will take those talents and translate them into her new job and create a lot of value for Google. Otherwise, it seems unlikely that they would be willing to shell out this much money.
Yeah. But they also needed someone with a lot of experience. This is an incredibly important, very senior role. She has been at Morgan Stanley for a long time. She's built up a lot of equity in Morgan Stanley. If she's giving that up, you need to compensate her for it somehow. Otherwise, she wouldn't leave.
All right. Fair enough. I want to talk about trade for a minute. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, it is the big, big Trans-Pacific trade deal that the Obama administration is working on. It is, Felix, running into some trouble, which is kind of interesting.
As with all of these deals, the left doesn't like it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we normally have a Democratic president. It's the Democrats who are negotiating it.
Right.
And a lot of his core base is saying, why are you trying to push through this trade deal, which is much better for big, you know, intellectual property companies than it is for laborers and workers? And it's true. It probably is. But it's doesn't necessarily make it a bad deal.
Well, and Catherine, also the I was going to say the administration, at least, you know, in their public statements and talks with reporters and things like that, they have not exactly espoused the view that Felix just gave. And they make the argument that there are, unlike in past deals, there are bigger protections for labor and for environment. Not be as much as you know, the unions
More to the point, the question is, what's the alternative? If the alternative is for the United States to disengage from the world and watch China put together a trade deal without any of these protections,
right,
then you'd be better off making this deal.
And any doubt at all that some version of this thing becomes law, Felix?
Massive doubt.
Oh, really?
Massive,
still, massive even doubt. Seriously?
Oh, absolutely.
Wow.
We haven't even seen this thing yet. We don't know if the U.S. government is even going to finally be able to come to terms. These trade negotiations drag on for years and years and years, and sometimes often just go to nothing.
Catherine, your thoughts? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, there's huge division amongst the Democrats about this.
Right.
The unions have threatened to withhold any sort of campaign funding from any Democrats who support the deal. So that in itself, I think, calls it into question.
All right. We got to go. Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post, Felix Hamner from Fusion. Have yourselves a good weekend, you guys.
Thank you.
The news from Dusseldorf and the French Alps about that German Wings plane crash this week gets curiouser and honestly more and more disturbing. It's one of those things that is unthinkable, but at the same time makes you think about a whole lot of stuff, which is kind of the way tragedy works sometimes, I guess. We've been doing another collaboration with the New York Times this week about lessons people have learned about money through their lives. Today, a lesson born out of one of those tragedies. Kenneth Feinberg was the administrator of the September 11th Victims Compensation Fund.
Generally, what I'm asked to do by policymakers, a judge, a president of the United States, an attorney general, a governor, a mayor, after some horrific tragedy, a decision is made to compensate victims. And I'm designated to design the program and administer the compensation to eligible claimants. What was the person earning over the course of a lifetime? What about pain and suffering? You try and come up with a formula that will compensate survivors who were injured or the families of those who lost loved ones on 9/11 or BP or General Motors or another tragedy. It is absolutely debilitating. You try and take a deep breath. You've been asked by the President of the United States to do the job and do it right. You're a professional. But unless you have a heart of stone, you can't help but be emotionally caught up in the individual tragedies that you're dealing with. 9/11 taught me that no one escapes life's misfortune, and that sooner or later, life can break your heart. And you had better plan today for the unanticipated tomorrow. Over half the people who died on 9/11 in the World Trade Center, the airplanes, the Pentagon, had no wills. Over half the people who died on 9/11 had no life insurance. I immediately, after 9/11, updated my will. I immediately bought additional life insurance. I immediately brought my family together, my wife, my children, and told them exactly what I wanted done with my estate. In other words, the fatalism that followed in the wake of 9/11 taught me to move and move fast. Everybody should have a will. As one sneaker manufacturer puts it, just do it.
Kenneth Feinberg is an attorney by training, but as you know, he spends a whole lot of time running victims' compensation funds. The current General Motors Ignition Switch program, for one, also the September 11th fund, as you just heard. You can find his essay and others from our collaboration with the New York Times online at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today to be filed quite possibly under the hubris tag. I don't know how we missed this, but earlier this week, the now former CEO of American Apparel, Dove Charney, decided to move forward with a $40 million wrongful termination lawsuit against the company he founded. Charney, you might remember, was fired after much Sturm und Drang and questionable conduct, I think you could say, much of it sexual in nature. I'm going to put my interview with Charney from about a year or so ago on our homepage because, really, you got to hear it to believe it. I'm telling you. Trust me. Marketplace.org is where you got to go.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
It's Friday, everybody. We got to go. The Dow up 34 points today, nearly 0.2%. The Nasdaq gained 27 points. That's 0.5%. The S&P 500 up 4 points, 0.2%. However, it was not a good week on Wall Street. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace was developed by J.J. Yor. Tommy Andres is the acting senior producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around here. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are back again on Monday. Have a great weekend. We'll see you. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.